after Hurricane Sandy, there is a big national conversation about the role of climate change and how it affected this hurricane. And certainly we saw Mayor Bloomberg and Governor Andrew Cuomo strongly state that we have old infrastructure systems, yet we have new storm threats. We've reached some sort of new situation when it comes to storm threats, and it's being seen on a regular basis. And in terms of global warming, the question is being asked again, is there causation here? And my answer, based on my interviews with many scientists and looking at systems and also talking with Dr. James Hansen, who's the nation's most famous climate scientist at the NASA Goddard Institute for Space Studies, he is saying there's systemic causation of global warming related to Hurricane Sandy. And what he means by that is if you look at the planet's ecosystems globally and systemically, then yes, climate change unquestionably played a role in creating the record size and energy of Hurricane Sandy. With climate change driven by the human combustion of oil, coal, and natural gas, we have systemically raised ocean levels in the Atlantic about 1 foot in the last century. We have systemically raised sea surface temperatures, which help fuel hurricanes, and you'll hear more about that in a moment. So we have systemically raised sea surface temperatures, and we have systemically increased moisture in the atmosphere with climate change. And if you look at all these systems, the idea that you could have such a record superstorm like Sandy and the systemic changes not playing a role is virtually impossible. So there appears to be strong systemic causation. Again, in my 2003 book, Predicted Hurricane Katrina, 2006 book, Ravaging Tide, Predicted Sandy. And unfortunately, unless we quickly solve the climate crisis, we can be pretty sure that a super hurricane fueled by global warming will eventually strike coastal Maryland and Virginia. Certainly, insurance companies seem to think so. In 2006, Allstate Insurance Company announced that it was abandoning coastal Virginia and Maryland. And indeed, in Maryland, Allstate Insurance will not issue new homeowners policies in the 11 easternmost counties. And Allstate gives as a reason for this the fact that Atlantic storms are becoming more powerful. Travelers Insurance just about a month ago mailed out flyers to millions of its customers, including me. I live in Montgomery County, Maryland, and I got a letter from Travelers saying that the cost of insurance is going up because of extreme weather. And they showed an illustration of a two-story home with a garage and a tornado about to hit it and ominous dark storm clouds overhead. Travelers Insurance quoted lots of stats on the growing cost of extreme weather and said that the gave as the explanation for this at the bottom of this flyer the growing impacts of climate change. And you have international insurance companies like Munich Re and Swiss Re saying the same thing. And just last year, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration pointed out that the United States set a record for most billion dollar higher natural disaster events. There were 14 of them in the United States in 2011, natural disaster events of $1 billion or more. So again, when you look at Hurricane Sandy, did global warming cause Sandy? Well, if you look at the planet's ecosystem systemically, then yes, climate change unquestionably played a role in creating the record size and energy of this hurricane. And that's all I have. We have the other two scientists who will speak, followed by questions. So Kelly, do you want to introduce Bill?
Sorry, I'm here. We'll have Dr. William Boycourt. As I said earlier, Dr. Boycourt is a professor of oceanography at the University of Maryland Maryland Center for Environmental Sciences. Dr. Boycourt, do you want to continue the call?
Yeah, I It's a bit timely. I just came from a two-day gathering. I was very fortunate to be part of that. In Baltimore, about 70 people. We happen to have the lead forecasters from the National Center for Environmental Prediction. That's a National Weather Service arm that does all the forecasting that sends it out, the official forecast. We had the lead forecaster that was Sandy and the head of the operation, Louis Buccellini. We also have the leading oceanographers from Cape Cod to Cape Hatteras who are doing these kinds of forecasts, especially storm surge, and the leading people who are doing this observing system from Cape Cod to Cape Hatteras called the Mid-Atlantic Coastal Ocean Observing System. We were debriefing Sandy and trying to find out what lessons we could learn, and it was particularly unanimous in a couple of conclusions. One, Sandy was an unusual storm. It was Kelly pointed out. It's unusually big. It was 1,000 miles across. Unusually late in the season. And it ran into that cold air front with a low pressure system that intensified it. This is not, the other thing that was particularly bad is the remarkably unlucky coincidence in the Battery in New York of the peak of the storm surge, which is driven by wind, with the high tide occurring in early evening that made a record almost 14-foot span above mean low water that flooded the subways in New York. That was particularly unlucky. Now, I refer to this as unusual, but we've seen this before, and that's important. We've seen the so-called perfect storm in 1991. Not the consequences to New York were clearly different. But that came out of actually Hurricane Grace was part of that. A low pressure system coming in, very similar. You probably heard that story. And then we as scientists always caution, and you've always heard this, you can't link one storm to climate change. But the consensus clearly in our gathering, and the was more than an elephant in the room, is clearly this is the beginning of what we're going to expect more. And the reason why we expect these large things more is simply because we have an increasingly warming sea surface temperature. And hurricanes are fundamentally heat engines. They require warm water to fuel the operation. And as Mike pointed out, we also have greater moisture in the air. Moisture makes the air lighter. So at the base of the hurricane, you have these, on the outer rings, you have these down drafts of fairly cool air. They get into this inward spiral along the surface of the ocean toward the center, toward the eye, that gradually pick up heat and moisture from the sea surface. At that point, it rises in the center and fuels this big circulation and powers this incredible strong heat engine. You know that if it goes over land, it slows down quickly. Why? First of all, because the land is rougher than sea surface, but more important, far more important, is that the source of heat decreases. So we were looking at those forecasts. I have to say that the National Weather Service did the forecasting remarkably well. They're a very courageous bunch. They're very clever. They're very dedicated. And the fact they hit it as close as they did was and also called for the warnings they did was remarkable. I just want to give them a very strong commendation here. So I think the lessons are clearly for us. In the large, we have the increasing strong hurricanes. They may come fewer. That's the evidence lately, the consensus, but they're going to be stronger and stronger. And so it comes down to the conclusion that we all have is that we need to mitigate this stuff really quickly. We have to have short-term mitigation. I commend some of the articles in the New York Times. One was this morning by Phil Lorton about the kind of small things we can do to help save New York while we do the larger long-term solution of reducing carbon emissions. Now, when we say long-term, we got to be careful here. That doesn't mean we wait long-term to act. The time to act is now, as I think we're all very clear about.
Thank you, Dr. Boycourt. Next, we'll hear from Dr. Court Stevenson. Again, Dr. Stevenson is a professor of coastal ecology and sea level rise at the University of Maryland Center for Environmental Sciences. Dr. Stevenson?
Yes, I agree entirely with Bill Boycourt about trying to really get to adaptation as soon as we can here, because it looks like we're in for a longer-term problem. Basically, sea level has been rising, especially in our area along the East Coast, about 1 to 2 feet per century, and that's due to two factors. One is the ice melt of the glaciers, and especially the land glaciers in Greenland, for example, you know, where we do have unprecedented melting this year. And the other factor is that when you warm water, it expands. And as you warm the sea surface, you especially get this secondary effect. Now, we've argued back and forth for the last 10 or 20 years about which component is more important. But nevertheless, it produces this problem at the battery where you started off taking tide gauge measurements in New York. You know, in the 1850s to present, we have a really pretty upward trend that has been even accelerating a little bit more in the last decade or two. So it's one of those problems that is accelerating slightly, and as we go forward, we really need to think about these things in terms of projections. I heard one commentator say about the engineering in New York that they couldn't quite ever engineer to this because it had never happened before. I think that that's totally a misguided principle, because I think we've got to engineer our infrastructure to the point where we can start to really take into account future projections. And that's where I think a number of us have a special worry, is some people believe that we could double the sea level rate by the end of the century, and that could even triple if we don't do anything in terms of attenuating our oil and coal uses. So I think with those kind of things in mind, we really need to do the opposite. Instead of looking back, we need to look forward in terms of you know, trying to figure out how to adapt. And, you know, I think Bill Boycourt made a good comment about there's a lot of little things that can be done as well as the big things. I've worked in Chesapeake Bay, and we've talked about adaptation for quite a while here in the last decade. In New York, they actually have a subcommittee that's been working on ways to harden New York against surges. And one of the things that most of us in this business have traveled around the world, we've seen tide gate surges in Europe, in the United Kingdom, and also now we've got three gates that are being installed in the Venice Lagoon. And I think a number of people are beginning to really now voice the question about whether we need tide gates on some of these cities. And that's a very long-term proposition in terms of figuring out how to really make those work. Especially in New York, it's tricky because you actually right now have three entrances into New York Harbor. If you're standing at the Battery, the south end of Manhattan, you're actually affected tidally by the Kilvan Cull, the Narrows, and Hell Gate, which is the entrance from Long Island Sound. So you might just put three gates on each of those. That's
that's a very daunting proposition, especially when you have major shipping going through the Narrows, which is the most important of the entrances. Nonetheless, I guess there's also other things that are being proposed, and one of them, or at least thought about, one of them is just to put a very large causeway and gate across the whole lower New York Harbor from Sandy Hook over to the Rockaways, where we had that fire. That's another huge project, and we've done things like that in the Netherlands, and there's engineers that really are pretty competent at that, but that's a major change in the ecology of the region, and frankly, I'm not so sure whether that's even a good idea, but we're going to have to probably do something in the future. The question is what we could do in the Chesapeake, and along these lines, population centers like Baltimore may need to really think hard about surge gates. If they're affected like they were in Isabel by a storm like this, which would have come further south, in other words, made landfall, say, instead of in Atlantic City than maybe in Ocean City, you would have had much more surge associated with this, and it probably would have energetically produced a similar kind of surge in Baltimore. Well, 14 feet in Baltimore would have been really pretty amazing. We've only had 7 or 8 feet before. So one of the things there is to try to figure out whether we need to think about or at least start to study the possibilities of the high gate there. The other thing is, of course, down in Norfolk, a lot of Norfolk actually is just about at sea level now. Some of it's only about 3 or 4 feet higher than sea level. And they're really trying to come to grips with some kind of a revetment system there. Whether they really need a gate or not is up to, you know, in the air. But they're really very much concerned about flooding because of all the naval operations there. So locally, I think we've really, since it seems like we're not doing very much globally about carbon emissions. In fact, we're going just the opposite. We've had the highest CO2 levels at Mauna Loa this spring that we've ever had, and that's the place where we usually measure it on the top of a volcano there, and for the global sort of index. And we expect to see things get worse. So these things may have to really come into fruition at one point. Now, one of the things as a citizen, you just ask, how many billion dollars is it going to cost to really harden these places? And frankly, I would like to see the opposite kind of a reaction is maybe we should try to do everything we can to keep other sources of energy in our mix and reduce our CO2 emissions. So with that, I'll leave it to questions.
Thanks, Dr. Stevenson. We'd like to now move to journalist questions. Just as a reminder, journalists on the call can dial *1 on your phone keypad to enter the question queue. And when it's your turn in the question queue, you'll hear a prompt letting you know that your line is unmuted, and you can then proceed to ask your question. Again, that's *1 to get into the question queue. And we've heard a lot from our distinguished speakers today. Thanks to all of them for joining us. I'm going to pause now for just a minute to allow all of you to get in the question queue, and then we'll proceed. All right, we'll now move to our first question.
Yes, earlier in the week, or a week ago now, we thought that this storm might come farther south and impact Washington much more directly. Had that happened, what are your projections for what that storm would have looked like and the effect that it would have had here. And as you look forward, as you look forward at the possibility of future storms and the scenarios that you suggest, what do you see as the possible worst-case scenario for the Washington region? Thank you.
This is Bill Boycott. I could probably answer that question. So if we studied the last bad storm for Washington when we studied Isabel, and we developed what was called a Chesapeake Inundation Prediction System, a remarkable partnership with the National Ocean Service, the National Weather Service, and a bunch of private sector and academic forecasts. And during Isabel, there was a lot of flooding in Alexandria and Washington. And why was that the case? Well, the last two major inundations we've had in the Chesapeake Bay region were 1933, when the storms were unnamed, and Isabel in 2003. And what was common to those is the eye of the hurricane went west of the Chesapeake Bay, so that the strong winds to the east of the eye blew water into the bay and then blew water up the rivers to the west. In this case, for Sandy, they happened to blow at the right time out of Washington. I was talking to people I was advising over there, and that was good. Things went down, but it also raised the water level in Tangier, Smith Island, and Crisfield, which flooded all three. We've done model runs, and the model runs for our numerical models of the hydrodynamics with different hurricanes driving it have shown that the bay is particularly vulnerable to these storms in the western side, and that includes Washington, because they blow the water into the bay, and if they move at what we call the natural frequency, about the same speed as the tide going up the bay, you can get what's called resonance, and you can get some very big worst-case scenarios. And those worst-case scenarios we run, and they need to be checked, can be upwards of 15 feet or higher in Baltimore and of that order in Washington, which, of course, you can predict and project what those kinds of devastations would be. They're less likely because in order for the storm to get west of the Chesapeake Bay, it has to go over land, over North Carolina and Virginia, and they'll have to be lower categories. But we ran category 3, 4, and 5, 5 unusual, unlikely, and there's some pretty strong, we need to do some more work with some pretty strong surges.
And this is Mike Tidwell. I also know it kind of depends on the characteristics of the storm as well. If you have a hurricane with a really tight eye wall, like Wilma, for example, and you have really sort of compact, tight, high wind speeds, a hurricane like that, if the eye were to get into the bay, you could see, almost a hurricane of pure ocean power within the bay itself, but it would have to be a tight eye wall. But just the sea level rise alone is creating the sea level rise from global warming is sort of creating an almost permanent high tide situation. Cort Stevenson talked about and Bill Boycott talked about the misfortune of having Sandy come ashore in New York as a during high tide. Well, with global warming, we're sort of permanently adding already 1 foot of tide or sea level, and there could be 2, 3, 4 more in this century. So you sort of have an ongoing problem worldwide with that. And, of course, the Potomac River is a tidal river as it passes through downtown D.C. So if you get a foot of sea level rise globally, you get a foot of sea level rise in Washington. So that's an ongoing problem in terms of flooding in low-lying areas near the mall, Alexandria, et cetera. And it creates more space for hurricanes to pass over, more water surface. So there could be multiple problems. And just getting back to Cort Stevenson's discussion about floodgates, the Thames River in England, there's a floodgate just downstream from London that keeps London dry after some catastrophic flooding in the 1950s that caused lots of deaths. They completed that floodgate on the Thames in the 1980s. And what it does is when the surge from a storm comes from the ocean side and comes up those tidal rivers and bays, then these floodgates close temporarily, preventing the surge from entering these populated areas and then reopening once the surge goes back down so that the rivers can flow back to the sea. And that's what you would have in New York. You would have these floodgates that would close temporarily, three of them, so that as the surge from a storm like Sandy approaches, they could be temporarily shut and then reopened to allow these the normal flow of these rivers and narrows back to the sea. And Court, you've supposed that in terms of Washington that we might need a floodgate there as well. Where would that be? How would that work?
Essentially, down at Mount Vernon, you could put one across. Of course, you have to really manage these very carefully because when you have a big watershed upstream, like we do in the Potomac, you also have a secondary flood that occurs after a hurricane often. So you've got to make sure you can open those gates quick enough. So it's a very complicated issue about where to put things and exactly, you know, how that would work. And that's why I think it's always good to get, you know, some studies underway to see how best to do that. But just for perspective, I was going to add, Bill Boykert mentioned a possibility of 15 feet at Washington. And, you know, that would take you to Constitution Avenue and up almost to Pennsylvania Avenue. It's almost the edge of the National Archives, where they have a lot of good things in the basement, like the Constitution, things like that. So this is really pretty serious stuff, and I really would like to see more action locally to really get some plans underway.
Plans like a floodgate.
Well, I think we should really start a flood a surge defense system, and whether that would entail a floodgate, I think is an open question. You want to go about these things in a pretty, rigorous and methodical way. But I think a floodgate would certainly be in the mix of things that you would want to consider if you're trying to harden the capital against the future surge from the hurricane.
What would be the other things to put in the mix?
Well, I think, you know, if you go to Venice and some of these areas. One of the things that they've done is a lot of little things that they've raised the plazas, for example, in a lot of areas. So you used to go to San Marco Plaza and they would have a little – they almost look like tables that you'd walk across at high tide when you had these – they have very, very pronounced tides that are happen every 5 to 10 years. And now they've actually raised the plazas 3 or 4 feet in various sections of the city, so you can walk across at these high tides. So, I mean, that's one thing. Another thing they've done in Venice is now at the thresholds of a number of doorways, they actually have these devices that they can put in basically batter boards. So if tides coming up, and they do get good warnings now on these things. They can put these batter boards in so the water doesn't come into the buildings. And, of course, Venice, the buildings are so precious that's really important. But we have some precious buildings on the Mall, too. I think we probably got to start thinking about a number of things in terms of our transportation system. I think it's only been lately that transportation people have been reckoning, I think, with the idea that they've really got to worry about surge and what that does to, you know, subways as well as highways.
Thank you.
Those are some really important points, Dr. Stevenson. And we do have another call now, so unless there's any follow-up on that one, let's move on to the next question. And also just a reminder that all journalists can press *1 to join the question queue, and we'll make sure to get to you. All right, for our next question.
I was wondering if there are any hard numbers of probability of storms like this? I know everyone's saying, yes, these storms are more likely, but do you have a comparison of probabilities?
This is Bill. I don't think that they exist. I think they would be difficult to come up with, but I'm not aware of any. Are you, Court?
I think the insurance companies are working on that. I've been contacted, and I think several of my colleagues have been involved with trying to figure out what probabilistic prediction you would make. But I think it's going to be it's fraught with all sorts of problems to make those. And I think Mike Tidwell's comment, though, was really important, is that some of these companies have decided that the probabilities appear to be too high. So they must have some back-of-the-envelope calculations already.
Yeah.
I would recommend that not just the insurance company, but the reinsurance companies be checked on that, because they are way out ahead. They were way out ahead of the insurance companies. We had a chance to run a symposium with the American Association of Advancement of Sciences back 4 years ago. It was Obama's birthday, and he was there too. But we were given money to invite all the experts on sea level rise from around the world, and we got them to attend. And I was fortunate to chair that session. But all the scientists were fascinating. But the most fascinating person of all that session was a young man from England, from a reinsurance company, who said, "It's not the rise per se; it's the extremes. And let me show you what the actuarial estimates are." And he gave some specific estimates there, but they were cautious. But I think I would back Court and say, if you're going for the best estimates, they're going to be from a reinsurance company.
And I would just say, if you change the question to say to ask, is a major costly storm probable or not probable in coastal Maryland and Virginia, then Allstate Insurance Company has already given an answer to that. They have decided it is probable, and therefore they will not offer new homeowners policies in the easternmost counties of Maryland and Virginia. They have retreated. They are pulling out of those areas. They're not a Republican corporation or a Democratic corporation. They are a corporation with their own capital at risk. And they have decided to get out of the new homeowners market in not only Maryland and Virginia, but I believe there are four or five other coastal mid-Atlantic states that they're pulling out of the coastal area. So they clearly see a probability.
I'd like to also emphasize Bill Boycourt's comment about the variability of the climate system, and that's one of the things I think we're coming to grips with right now is that sea level and also hot, dry years, and there's a number of issues that have emerged, I think, environmentally that are difficult to deal with because the climate can do a number of things. It can warm and then dry out a landscape, essentially, if you don't get the rainfall, and we think we've seen some of that. And then sometimes you get hot and cold fronts going back and forth more frequently. And, it seems like not this spring, but last spring, we had the situation that we had warming, and then we had this period when we had cold again. And at the same time, we had this variability in sea level rise, and we had one of the worst marsh growing springs and summer in 2011, and we really attribute that to this variability problem of not having the more or less mild conditions that we usually get. It's basically this up and down that we're worried about, as well as just the mean or the median, the average.
Court's right about that, and specifically We worried about this year, early last year, all the oceanographers from Cape Cod to Cape Hatteras pointed out that we have this unusually warm winter, unusually warm temperature, and the fisheries people were calling us to say, give us delineation of that because it was affecting the recruitment and population of fish. So we tracked that all spring. It turned out that the 5 months starting January of this year are the warmest months on record. So it's going back to what's causing weather, this warm weather helped. There's no question this warm weather helped fuel Sandy. Whether it's a direct cause and all that, we all feel that way, but we can't say for that particular storm. But there's no question this is a very bad setting for Sandy to crank up.
So for journalists listening, that voice you just heard was Bill Boycourt, Dr. Bill Boycourt, and the voice right before that was Court Stevenson. And as we continue to answer questions, I think we'll continue to identify ourselves for those taking notes and trying to establish attribution. So, Kelly?
Thanks, Mike. And if journalists in the question queue could also just announce your name and outlet as you ask your question, that would also be great. We do have more questions in the queue, so I'm going to move now to our next question.
It sounds like that question is not there. Should we go to the next one?
Yep.
Hello?
Yes.
Hello? Can you hear me?
Yes.
Yep. Oh, okay.
Go ahead and ask your question.
Sorry, I had it on mute. I was punching the wrong button. This is Tim Wheeler at The Sun. Question for Bill and Court. You talk about, you know, possibly putting in tide gates, surge gates at, for population centers like Washington or Baltimore. Of course, those are, you know, would help provide some rather expensive insurance for the really densely populated places. But what about all the smaller communities and the scattered settlement all along the shoreline here? Is there what do we tell those people? Or what do we do in terms of storm threats?
Well, Tim, this is Bill, and you know that Court and I live in those communities on the eastern shore of Maryland. We worked in Dorchester, which was 50% underwater during Hurricane Isabel.
Yeah.
It's a very low-lying county. And we saw some of the devastation. I think that there were in the thousands of homes that were affected and flooded in both counties of Talbot County and Dorchester, and they were not the worst. In terms of flooding, perhaps, but in terms of direct damage, the low-lying of parts of the lower western shore tributaries in Virginia got both storm surge and huge winds that just took a lot of trees down in forests. And I mean, that's the real damage. But the question is, what the consequences thereafter? My mind is meant that Dorchester has the question people come up to me when I talk, and I'm sure this is the case with Court, and ask, what do I do with my property? My children, do I give them to my children? Do I try to sell it now? There are people who are starting to talk about moving out. They're building berms around their property in the lower part of Dorchester County. Now for the regular Northeasters that come in and settle. So these have big consequences to the eastern shore of Maryland.
I think at a minimum, Tim, there needs to be increased conversation about where is building new building permissible along these low-lying areas of the bay. Many of the builders want to discount the scientific evidence that sea level is rising and that the land that they're selling or wanting to develop could be under 10, 11, 12 inches of water or more in the next decade. I think that we need to have more science drive much more of our standards for building along the coast so that we at least prevent new building in endangered areas. And then beyond that, I mean, I think that the continued hardening of coastal areas with riprap and bulkheading, you're obviously seeing more and more of that, very, very expensive. And I don't think it will be long, given the amount of sea level rise we seem to already have in the bank, that just the momentum of climate change and ocean warming that it's inevitable you're going to see increased levee building in certain areas, in addition to the probability of these floodgates. And that's all adaptation, of course, but as Bill Ancourt have emphasized, I think that it's going to be very, very hard to ultimately adapt to all of this if we're not simultaneously, quote-unquote, mitigating, i.e. reducing the carbon pollution that's causing the problem in the first place.
This is Court Stevenson. I would like to comment out on the two earlier suggestions. One that Mike Tidwell made, I think, is important about trying to really figure out what kind of structures that we need to encourage or discourage in these flood zones. Normally, we don't really have that much control about what gets put on the landscape, and I think we need to, on a regional basis, really think about that more. But not entirely just ban all sorts of construction, because I do think that when I was in Bangladesh, I saw that they really have had successful strategies in dealing with cyclones there at the head of the bay in Bengal, that you can get about a 20-foot surge there. They build these cyclone shelters, they call them, and they use them for schools or community things that are above the 20-foot level or 22-foot level, whatever you want to assign it. And they're built with concrete, and basically they can withstand, 100, 200-mile-an-hour winds or whatnot. So it might be that we could – I mean, I could foresee that we need to really think about these places that are pretty isolated now, like Hooper's Island, Tillman Island, Deal Island, instead of just trying to, expect that these people are just going to evacuate. Usually they don't. So it might be that we need to really rethink that and start to really figure out how we can accommodate people during these terrible stress times, as well as use the building, for a school or whatever. There's lots of things that could do with a really well-built hurricane-proof structure. And I kind of think maybe we need to think about things like that, as well as, hardening at least the arteries that the evacuation arteries. One of the things that's true in Talbot County, where I live, is that St. Michael's is at a low spot, and you have major population there for this county. But when it floods, actually, there's a low point in the road, and you really can just cut off a whole area from evacuation. So I think we really need to think about hardening those places from above any kind of storm surge levels. And I think that there are a lot of little things that we should be doing that usually everybody puts it aside because, the counties are hard up cash and we don't have a lot of state money right now.
Thank you. We do have two more questions on the line, so I want to make sure we get to those. And just a note to journalists that you can all follow up with me. This is Kelly at the Chesapeake Climate Action Network at 240-396-2022 if you do have specific questions that you want to follow up with any of our speakers today. But for now, I think to make sure we get to everyone's question, let's move to the next one in the queue.
Hi, it's Daryl Fears with the Washington Post. I came to the call late, so I apologize if my question is already stale. But I've heard talk of a floodgate to protect population centers in Washington and Baltimore, and I'm wondering how those would look to you, what would be the dimensions, and what would be the cost, because we've been talking to cities all along the Atlantic coast, and people have any number of ideas, but they're not supported by political will. They're not supported by money. Every time someone gets walloped by one of these storms, they start talking about this stuff, but it seems that rarely anything gets done. And so can you talk for a minute about what you envision as some type of storm protection, the dimensions of it, and whether and the cost of it, and whether you think it could ever get done?
Well, Darrell, this is Mike Tidwell. Certainly when you look at Holland and even London and other places in the world that have built really large seawalls or floodgates of some kind, they were almost all triggered by human tragedies, you know, significant death and property destruction caused by the flooding that was then controlled or tamed by these structures. Is the political will there now for a place like New York? You know, given that the mayor has said climate change is clearly here, we have old structures, but we have a new reality. Those are his words, and we need new structures while we solve global warming. I think that we may be close to getting the political will for some kind of adaptation in terms of floodgates in the three critical areas of New York City. In terms of Baltimore and Washington, as Court Stevenson was talking about earlier, you know, having some kind of floodgate on the Patapsco River could protect large concentrated areas of the city. I mean, clearly these things are very, very expensive. Another floodgate just south of Mount Vernon could stop the surge of a major storm coming up the tidal Potomac. But, you know, also very, very expensive. Who knows? I'm sure in excess of $1 billion. I mean, what was the Wilson Bridge? I mean, that was a pretty expensive infrastructure. My guess is that some sort of floodgate would be at least as expensive. But then the question is, you know, expensive compared to what?
Yeah.
Compared to $50 billion in damage from Sandy alone, given that Atlantic storms are rising in intensity, sea level is rising, the insurance companies are retreating or raising rates. You know, we're starting to reach a dollar threshold that starts to make even very expensive infrastructure adaptation start to seem cost effective.
Yeah, this is Court Stevenson. I would just answer the question and say, for Washington, you would expect it to be anywhere from 1 to 10 billion probably. 10 billion I use because that's what Venice is faced with and in their costs, U.S. dollars. But they have three different inlets, and we really only have one. But it entirely depends on the few technical considerations at each of those locations, just how much you'd have to spend, and also just what kind of gate you'd really want. Venice has opted for gates that come off the bottom, and you don't even see them normally until they're really used. So, I mean, that might have a lot of appeal, and one of the things is to, as those gates come online, I think a number of us would like to really study those and try to figure out whether, you know, that might work in the Potomac.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Great. Thank you, Darrell. At this point, we'll move to our next question.
Hi, it's Ashley Holdy, also of The Post, following up on Darrell's question. When you say $10 billion, you're talking about Venice. Is $10 billion the cost, up to $10 billion, the cost you anticipate for a floodgate at Mount Vernon, or would it, because it's a single estuary, be less pricey than that? Thanks.
Oh, I was just using the $10 billion figure. That's the priciest floodgate system that has gone into is just about to go into operation. When I said $10 billion, I just threw that out as probably the uppermost pricey floodgate system. And you really need to sit down and try to figure out where you're going to do it and just what kind of gate you're going to have And also what the surrounding geography is. You know, you try to put these things where you have a natural constriction so that you don't get anything around the gate. So I think the Potomac actually is a little bit better situated than some of these areas on that score. But, I mean, you know, anything that we would say in terms of costs are visionary and you know, they're not really actual in terms of, you need to really get an economic analysis that is much more rigorous than anything that we've done at all right now.
But you're thinking several billion dollars would be a reasonable estimate just off the top of your head.
Yeah, I mean, just based on the Venice experience, I've been over there several times as a consultant, and I've also been to the Thames Barrier, and I haven't been to the Scheldt. Rotterdam has a big gate that has been operational for quite some time, but that was a design that I probably wouldn't like for the Potomac. So I do like the Venice design in general, but the proof is in the pudding in terms of getting these things operational. So we'll see with time how the Venice situation works out.
Great. Thank you.
All right. At this time, we don't have any more questions in our queue, so I'd like to turn it back to our speakers for just very brief closing statements. Dr. Stevenson, would you like to kick us off?
Kelly, why don't we go to Bill first? I think he has a plane to catch. Bill, are you still on the call?
I am there, and I there's lots of issues here that are relevant, and we will take that later. And I'm sure Kelly has our contact information. I'm flying to Texas, but I'm willing to talk on cell phone, which I think you guys have. I think that, you know, it comes back to the question of political will. We're all experts on in this call. And, sometimes you feel a little bit crass using the tragedies to try to crank up the political will, but we're so frustrated with this political, season and decade and century that we have to find out ways to get people off the diet with regard to the political will. We can point out rationally how much the floodgates cost. We can point out rationally how much the total cost of ignoring global warming will be. And these are estimates are pie in the sky, but we know they're large. Or just Hurricane Sandy. Or Hurricane Katrina. These are huge numbers. The question is, how can we communicate to our representatives that the money up front and might involve revenue raising to pay for this? And this is a scientist crying out for a concerted effort for the ability to raise the political will at a time that's not exponentially dropping off from these crises. I'm happy that there are Chesapeake Climate Action Plan people out there and other people who are in the business of raising the consciousness.
Thanks again. That was Dr. William Boycourt, Professor of Oceanography at the University of Maryland. And now I'll turn it over now to Dr. Court Stevenson.
Well, I totally agree with Dr. Boycourt that we need to really better communicate, I think, as scientists, the urgency that we feel on a number of these issues. Unfortunately, I think for various reasons, the message has been muted in the last several years on a lot of levels about the impacts of global change. And I really think that I'd like to see a much more aggressive stance by a number of these jurisdictions. Maryland actually jumped out in front at one point, and I think it's managed to keep it on the horizon in terms of their planning. And, you know, I'm hoping that will be true in the district and as we go on in Virginia, too. So just a number of these issues are of concern to most of the scientific community, although we have our minor differences, for example, on, you know, just what the track of Sandy might have been, if it was a little bit, you know, to the south or north or whatnot. We really, most of us, I think, are convinced that it is a signal warning that needs to be heeded. And we just need to really get a lot more of our infrastructure designed with the idea that they're going to have to withstand more sea level rise. I have to mention that the Army Corps of Engineers that I've been working with have really begun to put all sorts of sea level issues into their structures that they're designing. For example, at Poplar Island, we're very, very aware that sea level will be an issue that we've got to really keep coping with as the century goes on. And I would like to see that kind of consciousness being displayed by a number of the governmental organizations as we go up and down the East Coast.
Again, that was Dr. Court Stevenson, Professor of Coastal Ecology and Sea Level Rise at the University of Maryland Center for Environmental Sciences. And now for our final closing remarks, I'll turn it over to Mike Tidwell.
Yeah, I just want to emphasize the theme that I began with, and that is in response to the question, did global warming cause Hurricane Sandy? The answer is certainly yes in terms of systemic influence. Again, systemic causation. We raised ocean levels through sea level rise, through the burning of fossil fuels. We raised the moisture content in the atmosphere worldwide because of the burning of fossil fuels. And we raised the ocean temperature, sea surface temperature of the Atlantic and all the other major bodies of water on this planet. If you take those factors together as realities that are measurable and provable right now, it is impossible for a superstorm to exist in the Atlantic and not be affected by those factors. So there is systemic causation. I think that you will hear more discussion of systemic causation from scientists and non-scientists moving forward as a way to understand this phenomenon. The other important point is we can only adapt so much. As the scientists on this call have said, there are almost certainly ways to engineer protections of ecosystems and populations through human projects, defense projects. But if you get into the, if you get beyond the 1, 2, 3 foot sea level rise into the 10, 15, 20, 25 from the disappearance of the Greenland ice sheet, I don't think you'll find anybody who thinks that Venice or the coastal Bangladesh or New York City or other human habitations around the world are going to survive. So the adaptation must coexist with mitigation, the reduction of the use of oil, coal, and natural gas. So anyway, thank you all of you for joining our speakers and for the journalists on the call. You can follow up with Kelly Trout. Kelly, do you want to give your phone number again?
Yep. Journalists can follow up with me at 240-396-2022. Again, that's 240-396-2022.
Thanks, everyone.
Welcome. Yep.